All right. Well, thanks for coming to my session. My name is Sarah Franzek, and the topic of our discussion today will be Proverbs 31. And I guess I'd like to make sure that you understand that this is kind of an interactive thing. If you have any questions as we go, you can interrupt me. Or if I pause and it sounds like I asked you a question, it's because I did, and that you can answer. So I'm just going to begin, and then just feel free to chime in, because I think we need to have a forum to share our experiences. So we'll start. And like many of you, you probably begin your Sabbath evening with a reading of Ishtahil as part of your night time, after you light the candles. And, well, during Ishtahil, my husband holds my hands, and he says these kind words to me, and I always think, like, am I really that person? Like, could I possibly be worthy of all of that kind of praise? And I started thinking about that, and I wanted to really understand what it meant. So I decided to look into it, and for about the last year, I've been kind of contemplating it off and on, and this is kind of what I've come up with. So as a newly married woman, I struggled with the role I should play and in a marriage. And I grew up in a feminist society, as most of us did. And we got lots of really clear instruction, really strong instruction, about as strong as, like, Gumby, right, of how to be a good wife and what kind of adult we should be and how we should behave in a marriage. And then I met this Proverbs 31 woman, and I thought, could she possibly be real, and could that person really exist in the world today? And so we're going to begin this look at this person, and we're going to start with the first three verses. So we're going to start Proverbs 31, verse 10, and I'll kind of read the verse, and then I picked out a few key words. And I have the Hebrew of those words and some definitions from Strong, and then a discussion. So that's the format it's going to take. I will not go verse by verse. I've grouped the verses into like categories, because that's the way my brain works. So you'll have to bear with me, because I'm going to jump around a little bit, but it's not so much that it's entirely confusing. So we'll begin with verse 10. An excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. If we look at the word excellent, that's the word hail. And if you, the Hebrew definition of the word hail can mean strength or might, efficiency. It means wealth or army, stability, strength. And I think, how can I possibly be an excellent wife? How can I fulfill that word? How can I work a full-time job and manage my garden and my farm and my family and still be a good wife? How could I possibly meet my husband at the door at the end of every day with my pearls on, right, and just look gorgeous with, you know, angelic children? And how can I possibly be that person? But that's not really what the scripture says, does it? It says that that wife is powerful and efficient and wealthy. And hail is a word to describe armies. So how could I be a woman that could be described with a word that's used to describe an army? Because I'm just one person, as we all are. You know, sometimes our jobs need an army to get them done, it feels like, and it becomes overwhelming. So I kind of came up with a list of things that were right up off the top of my head. I could probably manage my time a little bit better. You know, a little less Facebook, a little more chores. You know, I could read things that are more quality, you know, not glamour or... You know, not so much fun stuff, but more edifying things. I think we could probably put more of those things into our life. I could probably manage my money better. I can look for better deals. I can grow a better garden. I can put goods away. I could start a savings account or put money away in a better fashion. And because this woman is not only efficient and wealthy, but she's also, most importantly, she's a force. And she uses that trait to accomplish many other tasks she takes on. So I feel like if my husband comes home and dinner's not ready yet because I'm still dirty from being outside and doing all the chores that I need to do, I might not be June Cleaver, but I'm still going to be a Kyle wife. So moving on, verse 11. Excuse me. The heart of a husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. Now, the word for gain here is shal'al, which means plunder or spoil or booty. And I think these are words of war. And I don't, do we have any pirates in here? Because that's the other thing that came to my mind. It's like, if you're not a pirate, this might not really make sense. And so all throughout Scripture, we know that men were called to war. And they would leave for many months at a time or years. And upon their return, what do you think that they would expect to see? You know, would they expect to see their vineyards in good order and their houses in good order? Of course they would. So if they couldn't expect their wife to take care of this, would they ever go to war? No. No. So our husbands don't leave for war. Or if they do, they would expect us the same thing of an ancient husband would, that we would be good stewards of our family's resources. So I guess my advice here, my thought here was, whether your husband's at work or at war or in the bathroom, he should be able to trust you with the credit card and the checkbook. So if you're running to eBay or or to Craigslist or buying something every time that he's away, maybe that isn't the most responsible way to hold a relationship. Ephesians 5:22 and 24 says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. His body is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to everything to their husbands." And, you know, I think it's the first time of us, the last time we read that was like when we got married. You know, every time you go to a wedding, you hear that. And really, what do you, you're not listening to the words that are being read. You're looking at the dress. And you're waiting to see if he's going to pass out or whatever. But we really need to take those words to heart and be sure that we follow our husband's lead and submit to him, even though that's probably one of the hardest things for women to do. Is to fall under somebody else's authority. And we fight against our mothers as teenagers, and then we pick fights again when we get married. We pick them with our husbands. And that's not really appropriate behavior. So can you imagine explaining to God that you really need to buy a $5 coffee? You know, you... or whatever extreme thing that you think you really need. So it would go something like, Lord, well, I really need the coffee to help me wake up, and you made the plans for our healing, and that's why I didn't help spread your gospel with our excess money that you blessed our family with. I mean, how uncomfortable would that conversation be? So why do we feel like we need to be snide and snippy with our husbands when we try to explain our choices? And we tend to bite back when they say, well, why did you use the money that way? And we go, well, it's none of your business. Well, it is your business. You know, because it's their job to keep our households together. And we have to remember that it's important to put a family budget together and be diligent about keeping our family's finances sound. It's important to do that budget with your husband and follow the budget. We can't be selfish, putting our own wants and desires before the needs of the family. And I understand the need for a pair of cute shoes and that it's really tempting to just go out and buy them. But we have to remember that whether it's shoes or coffee, we have to remember where our idols are. And if we're making shoes into idols, we can't make fashion idol. And when we fail to keep that budget, we should have a contrite spirit and not be defensive. And we should say, hey, look, this is what I did, and I'm really sorry, and I can take them back if you want. Mm-hmm. And keep the receipt. So moving on, verse 12. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. The words does him is actually the word gam'al, which means to deal fully with recompense. And there's other meanings, but the one that really struck me was to wean a child, or to be weaned is the root word of those words. So I thought I knew what that meant until I ran across this whole weaning thing. And then I started thinking about that because my son's 18 months old. And we went through that weaning thing in the last year. And so this verse isn't just about being nice, is it? You know, it's about dealing with your husband in a truthful manner. But there's more. It's about enabling your husband to achieve his full potential. Weaning a child in Scripture has to do with taking the child to the stage at which he's ripe to leave his mother and continue to grow while eating solid food. And we've been there. You know, most of us have had kids, and you know, you hope that your children can get to the point where they finally can eat by themselves, right? and it's kind of a relief off of us, but it's also something for them because they can't grow bigger at a point. They have to have that addition of other food. So weaning in ancient Hebrew society was celebrated with a feast and was looked on as a joyous occasion, much like a harvest. And to do good to your husband in this manner means you must understand his dreams and his talents and help him to ripen those thoughts and skills to their full potential. We have to nurture our husbands. And the first thing that we can do to be a nurturing wife is a negative thing. We have to stop nagging. We have to stop being a nagging sort of wife, which we've all done. Proverbs 7:15 and 16 says that a continual dripping on a rainy day and a quarrelsome wife are alike. To restrain her is to restrain the wind or to grasp oil in one's right hand. Our husbands trust us not only with a family budget, but also with the treasure of their hearts. If you wish to build up your husband and to help him find his full potential, you shouldn't start by saying, honey, I wish you were richer, I wish you were smarter, I wish you were funnier, I wish you were more accomplished. Those blows can be just devastating to a man who has entrusted his love in you. Proverbs 14:1 says that the wisest of women builds her house, but folly with her own hands tears it down. And how many of us tear down our houses on a daily or weekly basis because we tear down our husbands? So make it a point to look at the good points of your husband. By doing that, you elevate him and in turn yourself. First, endeavor to understand his dreams and then build him up concerning them. This brings me to my next point. You should note the good things your husband does and show your gratitude. When you're feeling frustrated or depressed, which is the biggest complaint I ever hear from my girlfriends, is that they're depressed. How many depressed women are there out there, right? Showing gratitude to your husband for the things that he does softens your heart, and it brings about more peace and happiness and compassion in our homes, which should really be our goal, because that's going to make our spirits more peaceful. In turn, God provides us with self-composure. So if you endeavor to bring peace into your house, God gives you composure. I don't know how many times I was in a sorority in college, and how many times I had to deal with young women who had eating disorders, and they would cut themselves. And when I'd ask them why, it's because they didn't have self-composure, and they felt that this abuse of their bodies would help them. It helped them emotionally focus on something. Yeah, weird, huh? Yeah, I'm not a psychologist. I was just, trying to keep people from dying. But I think it's interesting that that's the description that we give it, that we try to impart some kind of composure in our life, when really, if we provide peace, God gives us composure. And isn't that what we are looking for when we go shopping? How many times did I, self-medicate franticness by going shopping? Yeah, I'm still paying off, money from shopping too much. Yeah. Or when we go to the coffee shop for that, that five-minute break, and we're like, oh, yeah, I need my iced chai tea latte with soy milk, right? And it stops your day, and you're like, and you take a breath, and you get that composure. So we try to grasp that time away from our daily work, and so we can feel in charge, but we're not really in charge, are we? Right? Yahweh is in charge. Our husbands rule our lives. But we should be really the reflection of the love that they're giving us. So we provide peace. Yahweh provides self-composure, and our husbands can provide us with love. And in all of that, it makes a really nice picture. So 1 Peter 3, 1 through 2 and 6 says, likewise, wives, be subject to your husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. When they see your respectful and pure conduct, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you are her children, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. So moving on, I have grouped the next set of verses together as they describe how the excellent wife provides for her family. And I'm going to take a look at these at more of a historical point of view, and then try to apply them to modern day, because they seem kind of archaic when we read them. So verse 13 says, she seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. Wool and flax are the raw materials for making cloth. We all have had, maybe you inherited your grandma's linens, or you have a wool suit, or whatever, my cat. They're the raw materials for making cloth. So both of these materials need to be processed and spun into yarn before they are woven into a fabric and finally made into clothing. Portions of this process are referred to in verses 19, 21, 22, and 24 in chapter 31 of Proverbs. So I'm going to read those. 19 says that she puts her hands to the distaff and her hands support the spindle. 21, she is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. 24, she makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Making cloths in the ancient world was a really long process. How many of you have ever spun or carded wool? Okay, so you have a taste of that. In the case of wool, for the people that haven't gone through that process, the first thing you have to do is, you know, get a sheep. Yeah. And you have to have enough of them that you're going to make any kind of bulk of a product. So you have to feed the sheep and grow it up. And then when it gets to the point that it can be sheared, you have to shear the fleece off the sheep. And sheep are rather skittish. They don't really appreciate the fact that, especially now, I mean, our clippers are loud, and that kind of freaks them out. I suppose if you had scissors, it might be quieter, but it'd take a lot longer. So I hear goats are a little bit easier to deal with. After the fleece is sheared, you have to pick all the plant and manure debris out of this, which is called skirting. And we actually hired a high school student to help us skirt once, and she told us after she was done that she would never, ever come back to the farm ever again. Because it's, like, the worst job. Who wants to pick out poop for an entire day? Nobody. So, and it can take quite a bit of time. So after you do that, you have to wash the fleece, and you're removing the dirt and the lanolin out of the fiber. And then you have to dye the fiber. And that's the dye is also referred to in this set of verses. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, which you probably already heard some of it. But in the ancient world, dyes were derived from many different sources, plants, animals, minerals. But the purple dye that's referred to in these verses is probably Tyrian purple or royal purple, which is the same purple or teclet that is in the tzitzit blue. So that was historically and is made from the mucus of the hypobrachial gland of a murex snail. Okay, anybody know where to find a murex snail? No. Do you know where to find the hypobrachial gland and how to milk that? Because I'm, yeah, I don't either. So, I'm imagining she probably got it from a market somewhere. and following washing and dyeing is carding to the fleece, carding the fleece to get all the fibers running in the same direction. And from that point, you can start to spin the wool into yarn. Linen yarn is a little different because instead of an animal source, you're going to start with fiber from the flax plant, which is really cute. It's got little purple flowers, and I guess it's pretty cute until you start this next part, which is you have to harvest the plant, and then you let it rot. Yeah. So you tie it into bundles, and you throw it like at the edge of the pond, and you let it get soft, and it breaks down the edge of the fiber. And you could break it up into fibers at that point. But one of my spinner friends said that she'll never do it again. She didn't want, never again. She like, it took her months for her fingers to heal from spinning flax. Because it just rips your hands to shreds. So it can be really hard on your body, apparently. Another process that's referred to in verse 22 is batting and felting. And batting is arranging carded fibers into large sheets of fibers. So we've all seen, like, comforters and how they're made out of bats of cotton. Well, let's just be bats of wool. And then the bats, to make felt, you wash and agitate bats, and they flatten out, and that's how you get felt. So after doing all of these processes, you can make clothing by either weaving it together into a fabric, or in the case of felt, making sewn pieces. Okay, so some of you might think, big deal, I go to Walmart. and I believe what you can draw from this is that women worked hard to dress their family, not just in any type of clothing, but clothing that would keep them warm and signified that they were special. Purple clothing was expensive, as was fine linen, and this woman gave her family the best that she could. Remember that she wasn't wasteful in her work or her purchase. She bought and made clothing for beauty and utility. Today we buy clothes, we must ask if the item is both beautiful and useful, or if we are just purchasing it for more superficial reasons, like your girlfriend got one too. 1 Peter 3:3-5, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands. Personally, I'm shocked at the immodest clothing that's available for purchase for both girls and boys in stores, and I once asked a mother why she dressed her daughter in such revealing clothes, and she gave me a suite of excuses, which I'm sure she worked on because they came out really quickly. The first one was that there wasn't anything else to buy. Hannah Montana was all there was. And I'm like, okay. So it continued, if my daughter didn't have these clothes, her friends would tease her. My daughter looks so cute in these clothes. Those were the kind of excuses that she gave me. But you notice none of the reasons for buying the clothes was the same as the woman's valor's reasons. These clothes weren't purchased to keep her daughter warm or to signify her specialness. It was bought so her daughter could be the same as everybody else. Should that really be our goal as parents, to enable our children to conform? Romans 12:2, do not conform to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, by testing you may discern what is the word of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Her eye for the best was rewarded because she could sell the excess to merchants. And this brings us to the next set of skills that an excellent wife must have. She must be a savvy businesswoman. The Proverbs 31 woman is savvy. She cares for her family out of the increase of her investments and the commitment of her spirit. The following set of verses is about how Proverbs 31 woman reaches out to the community and to the world. Verse 14, she's like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. And do you ever get tired of meat and potatoes? Like, you look into the pantry and you're like, I have no idea what I'm going to make. And so you just make whatever that thing that you make all the time is, whether it's tuna salad or, you know, hot dogs, or something, right? You just find that thing that you fall back on. I like to think that the Proverbs 31 woman would reach out into the world and buy exotic and tasty spices for food to feed her family. And wouldn't it be neat if we could bring a little extra culture to our family through their plate? Whether we talk about Moroccan food or Indian food or whatever, but add a little tasty bit of the world into our families and talk about other places. And we have to remember that the Hebrew culture was very, they had their traditions, and it was definitely a separate culture, but they were also influenced by merchants from other places, by travelers. I mean, they lived, pretty much right next to the sea. I mean, it was influenced by other places. So remember that when things get drab at home, like in the middle of winter, make a curry or something. Anyway, side note. Verse 15 says that she rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and portions to her maiden. This woman rises before everyone else in her house to provide food for her household. She must kindle a fire, a hard task for anybody who's inexperienced, and begin the task of food preparation. In the morning, I am the first one who gets up in my house. Anybody else? The first one who gets up? Yeah. In the winter time, I would light the fire and get the house heated, and I hated this time in the morning. And I would have this just horrible, begrudging spirit because the house is cold, and I would go downstairs and be like, oh, I didn't bring wood in last night. And so I'm cold and I'm tired and I have to go outside and I have to get wood. And I would come in and I was mad about the whole thing. And then I realized that I can light a fire faster than anybody I know. And if I was on Survivor, I would totally rock that fire lighting building challenge thing. And so that's how I decided that I would go with each morning, is that if I, like, that I was on Survivor and that this is the best thing that I could do and that I was going to make it through that morning because I am the best at the fire lighting challenge. And I think that if we can all approach our chores like that, that there's that one thing that you're awesome at, then maybe that's something that we should really start our days with and find some joy in that. And I thought that the last bit of the verse, which says, and portions to her maidens, was about giving food to servants. That's what I always thought it was about. But the Hebrew word chach, which I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing any of these words right, means portion. That's the way it's translated, as portion. But it means statute, ordinance, limit, or something prescribed. And I went, oh, that makes some sense. So the excellent wife rises early. She makes food, but she also begins the rest of the tasks for the day by delegating tasks to others. She's a successful manager represented in Proverbs 31 because she manages people throughout the day. Some of them might be her families or her friends or servants. But rather than only giving them a task, she gives them duties and the authority to accomplish those duties. And it's important to give people the authority to do what you tell them to do. If you say to your youngest daughter, I want you to dust, and then you're going to stand over her and watch her dust every second, she's not going to feel any ownership in that duty. She needs to be able to do that with your trust, even if she breaks a couple of things here and then, you know. It's going to have to be okay. So I know a woman who cooked her first meal the day after she was married. Never had cooked before in her life. And I asked her why she didn't learn to cook from her mom. And she replied, my mother was bothered by my presence in the kitchen and was more efficient on her own. And I thought, what a pity to find ourselves in a situation where we are bothered by the opportunity to teach our children. A successful manager can train a child on a chore not only for the benefit of you, their mother, but also for the benefit of the child, because we can't send our daughters and our sons into adult life without skills. I mean, seriously, make some scrambled eggs with them or something. Just something so they can make it in life. There has to be some task in your home that your kids would love to do, and they just don't know it yet. Yeah, I know. I can give you an example from my own personal life. I thought it was the bestest fun as a kid to scrub the shower. Yeah, weird, huh? Yeah, I would put on my bathing suit and I would scrub the shower and I would just make sure the whole thing, because it was fun to play in the water. And, you know, we used like baking soda and vinegar, so it wasn't bad for me or anything. But yeah, it got done. So there's always something, and it's fun. So verse 16. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. Anybody have a vineyard? I got some Concord grape plants growing in the back here. But this excellent wife, contrary to popular belief, was about the... People have these traditional views of wives in their heads, and she's not locked up in the house. She's not barefoot and pregnant. She might be pregnant, but she's not locked in the house. So this woman takes part in successful business transactions of her own. She has her own property apart from her husband. This might be because of the dowry system. I really didn't have enough time to figure that out, but that was my best guess. We don't have dowries now, but if you marry later in life and you come into, and you already have your own money when you start, maybe you should be thinking about, if you're not married yet and you're making money on your own, investing and having something to bring into that marriage that's of value. She not only buys the field, but it yields increase due to her management. And with that money, she buys a vineyard to increase income farther. So she is able to function in a business setting where she's going to have to talk to merchants. She's going to have to sell her wares. She has servants or people working for her, and she's able to manage all of those people and still come out on top. I mean, that's a pretty hard thing to do. So verse 17, she dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. So my husband told me I have to put the literal meaning of this verse, and that would be that the woman of valor is not a namby-pamby, but rather she is strong and she knows how to work. She isn't lying in bed for 23 hours a day popping bonbons in her mouth like I once saw on a Dr. Phil show. And she has a strong body and she can do work. Additionally, this verse is about social and political action in the community. Some translations say that she girds her loins with strength. This means she is surrounding herself, specifically her back, with strong people who will support her and her cause. So my question is, who has your back? Have you made friends in your community who have come to the aid of your reputation? And when I say community, I don't mean the people here that you see once a year. I mean your neighbors and the women that surround you on a normal basis. Have you even made friends in your community at all? I know that a lot of us live out way in the country, and we love it for the precise reason that we are secluded. And, I mean, I don't really even want to go talk to my neighbors because they're weird. So I'm sure that's the way they feel about us. Yeah. But is this something to think about? Are we really called to live in seclusion? But I think we're really intended to live in communities of believers. So just as a thought, have you considered building your own community or moving to a community with more like-minded people? Do you actually feel comfortable letting your kids play with other families' kids? I mean, We're not really meant to live in seclusion, especially women. We're not meant. That whole quilting bee thing should really find a new generation. So just some good thoughts, you know. Verse 18 says that she perceives that her merchandise is profitable and her lamp does not go out by night. The word perceives is the Hebrew word ta'am, which means to taste, perceive, to eat. And I thought, ah, the taste of success. This woman has had great success, and her successes aren't short-lived. They continue. She looks, verse 27 says, she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. So what's the secret to success? It's don't be idle. We are charged to earn the bread that we eat and not to settle for food given to us because of our own laziness. When we are idle, we avoid work. We all have done that. We've all thought there's that one chore that we don't want to do, and instead of doing it, we flip on the TV or we take a nap because it can wait, right? It has to be something else to do other than dust the house or whatever it is. I mean, you guys have chores that you just hate doing? Yeah. So we convince ourselves that the chore can get done some other time and our entertainment's more important and should, for some reason, take precedence. How can we avoid idleness? Perhaps we should remove the temptations that keep us from being productive, or perhaps the reason for our idleness is deeper. Idleness can be a symptom of iniquity. When we aren't following the Torah, when our hearts are seeking after something other than peace and love and Yahweh, we find ourselves in the same place as Sodom. Ezekiel 16:49 says, "Behold, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy." How many of us think, I mean, when we think of Sodom, is that really what we're thinking? We're like, no, there was another reason they were destroyed by fire. But really, what the word says, they were destroyed by pride and idleness. And those are easily things that we could get to on a daily basis. So the excellent woman is also charitable. Verse 20 says, she opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. The word hand in English, it has two uses in the verse. There's the first hand and the second hand. But the first hand in the verse is the Hebrew word kaf, which refers to the hand's palm. So here, the woman, I'm not supposed to move with this thing. Here the woman is extending her hands to the poor. So to be an example, this is my friend Amy. Sit, stay. Here's Amy. She's the poor. And the example would be like this. Okay, I'm extending my hand to Amy with my palm. Okay, the second use of the word is, the word for poor in the first sentence, I'm sorry, this is so confusing. I'll read the sentence. She opens her hand to the poor. Okay, so we're still in the first sentence. That first use of poor means afflicted, humble, wretched, lowly, okay? The poor are people who are afflicted to the point where they can't work and they need support of the community, hence the opening of the palm. And the second instance of the word hand is the Greek word yad, which refers to the hand and possibly the wrist and arm moving in action of strength. So that would be more like this. Okay? So, let me find my place again. This time, the woman isn't just reaching down with her hand. She's reaching down with her arm, her hand, and all of her strength. We've already talked about the woman's strength. It's not just what's in her body, is it? It's her community. It's everything that's behind her. And these people, the word is ephion, which is the word needy. And the the meanings of it could be in want, a person who's oppressed or abused, a person who needs deliverance from trouble, and especially people who need deliverance by God. These are needy. They're different than poor people. These people need a leg up. They need a job. They need a place to stand on their own two feet so that they can just make it. They just need a little bit of help. And here the virtuous wife is reaching down to help that person up, giving them that leg up that they need, because she has worked hard to build her own household so she can help other people. So what can we learn from this high woman concerning her interactions with the community and the world? This woman is loving, she's giving, she's strong, she works hard for her living and protects herself while leaving her heart soft so that she can be charitable without feeling contempt from those who need her charity. Sometimes chores don't feel like they're going to get us anywhere but dirty and sweaty and gross. But take a page out of the Excellent Wife's book and be a wise manager. If your current investments aren't earning you a profit, switch things up. If you feel time-strapped, reconsider the delegation of your responsibilities to order children or other helpful people appropriately. Feeling lonely or weak, maybe you need to get involved with your community. A strong network can help you feel less like an island. And I think of that Simon and Garfunkel song. Yeah, I am a rock, I am an island. And then he goes on to say that a rock feels no pain and the island never cries. Yeah, right. Okay? We all feel alone, and we all know that it can be really tough to be an island. So finally, when you see that your work can create great success, don't become lazy. Don't lay in bed for 23 hours eating bonbons, but rather take time to reach out to others who can use some of your surplus or give a leg up to someone who may have fallen on hard times. And that's really the end to my talk, except I have one more verse that I want to share with you, and that's Titus 2, 3, and 5. And this is really more of an outreach that for next year, that older women likewise are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good and train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. I think that it's important for our mothers and our grandmothers and the people in our communities that are taking the place of those mature woman figures to really grow up the younger wives and the teenagers that are in our fellowships, because they are as lost in the process as you might have felt when you were first starting and they need advice. So don't be afraid to give advice, because your gray hair will get you a lot of forgiveness. And so that's my talk. And we have about 15 minutes for questions, or I don't know how good at questions I'm going to be, but I'll try. Or just discussion. That's what I would rather see, is that good advice from woman to woman would be appropriate.
Do you really see that this is attainable? Because I have seen and I go through this and think, there's no way. There's no way that I can, speaking of, I'm in a position right now where it seems like I'm doing a lot of these things, but I'm accomplishing none of them well. As far as helping out in the business and raising the children and trying to provide well enough for them, I'm not just speaking about clothes, but for their personality needs, their different bits and growth and ways that they need to be taught and trained, and it just seems like you know, when you're spread out and there's so many of these things right here, yeah, you can do it, but you're not doing any of them well. I mean, that's just
right. Yeah. I understand that. I understand that. I'm supposed to repeat questions for the recorder. No, that's okay. I just have to sum it up. So can we really do all of this well? Can we really become an Isis tile and do it perfectly? And no, we can't. We can't do it all alone. If we have an appropriate support system, we can do it a lot better than if we were alone, which is another example. In the Isis Hive, where she has a community, she's built up around her. But I think the best thing to do is prioritize. And if you can... And, you know, when it comes to whether your house is clean or your kids are moral, you're going to choose whether your kids are moral. You know, big deal if you haven't cleaned the bathroom in a week. So you choose the thing that has the more, you know, if your kids are immoral, that's a more negative consequence. So I think you're trying to make things turn out in a more positive way. And I think there's some things that we can let slide.
Well, that's what I really teach this. Sometimes when you hear about health care, mine is like, oh, man, I really want to hear that. You know, but you really brought out simple, practical steps. And I think one of the hardest things as women is we have such high expectations for ourselves. And we so want to feed our families. We so want to shine and be right. And a lot of times our husbands are very happy with most of what we do, but we're the ones that go, oh man, I didn't get something. Oh my God, you know. I mean, and we really need to lay off that because that makes at least my life of seeing that negative attitude just throw my entire family into a tailspin, which is not what the Proverbs 31 is about. I mean, it's about us building up our family and. And yeah, you don't want total chaos, but each family has its dynamic of what it can deal with. And you work with your husband on that to, if he's happy with what you're doing, and you're making an effort towards these things to be well-rounded and to please God, we got to be happy with ourselves on that. And a lot of these things that I'm hearing, I'm like, oh my goodness, oh no, that's you? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm adaptive here, and you know, God, how do you, if you want me to do this point in my life, we still all have seasons in our life.
Right.
I will be able to do something better when I'm older, when my kids are older, than I will now. And show me how you want me to work in that now. And we've got to be gentle with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, a good illustration that I found, I couldn't tell you what rabbi said it, but there was a rabbi that was speaking, and he was saying that women are like the moon and men are like the sun. Have you all heard this? We should reflect what our husbands give us. If your husband thinks you're doing fine and you think you're doing lousy, you're not reflecting your husband, and he is your proper mate. So you're reflecting something else. And if you have to eliminate what that something else is, because you need to realize that your husband's probably happy with you. So we're just about out of time. So anybody have a quick question or comment?
I think we should have a network. More of a network. We can get each other's email addresses. You know, I think that I pray for all the time that I don't write her like I should, you know, and say, you know, we can pick up the phone and call each other, you know, if we're thinking of someone, you know, that's one of the things I want to do. But when I first started this year, I thought, you know, I'm going to make it a priority this year to try to call people every day. You know, because I pray for you all the time, and she's up there all by herself. And how many of us, you know, this little lady comes, she's got five children, she's helping her husband start a new business. moved across the country with 5 children. And she so hard on herself, and she said, she could mother. And, you know, we need to hear that from each
other. Yeah.
And you're doing okay. And, you know, even be able to call and say, you know,
right. Yes, encouraging each other is really important. And while we're here at the feast, you know, exchange your information if you want to keep up with somebody, and then you can be a light in somebody else's life. And just when your friend's going crazy, you can be there for her. So, all right. Well, thanks. Oh, Shannon.
You know, nobody has it. Nobody is a perfect 31 woman, but you don't ever shoot for something so big.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to go for yourself. And he gave us a beautiful example of what we can do in some ways. And some people would be really great at this part, and some people mm-hmm. are really great at that part, and some people might be okay at both. You know, and don't ever think less of yourself than you think someone else has got it all together. I can guarantee they don't. So we put on this front that, oh, I'm great, I've got it, I'm good, I'm perfect, and if I just smile hard enough, everyone else will think so too. And we're robbing ourselves of the ability mm-hmm. to come alongside our sisters and lift them up.
Right.
Because pretending is so hard that we have it all together. And so I just encourage you that way, yeah, you know, stay in contact with each other, but don't be pretending so hard you've got it so together that you can't ask for help and you doubt for help. Mm-hmm. Because then you rob yourself of these blessings over yourself and for the other person.
Christian parents, and that is really good. The spirit to network, but when we're not able to network, I think focus is key. And practicing the presence of the two of us, especially